people in the Torah, the five books, I mean, all their sins were never in halacha. All the greats, even in Tanakh, throughout Tanakh, it was an emotional decision that they made. It wasn't in halacha. They say King Solomon made a mistake in halacha. That's a very difficult. It's not that simple. But the thing is that... So these greats, I mean, it's all decisions. Like Yaakov, he bought the coat for Yosef that was going too far, you see. So it wasn't against halacha. It was an irrational, either something philosophically wrong or the way to raise your children, something he made a mistake where the emotions affected his thinking process. Both the Metzudas David and the Rabbeinu Yonah quote a Gemara by the sinner that it says, Avera Gereres Avera. One sin causes you to do another. Okay? I don't think that it says by the righteous that it means that it would not befall them completely. But they're each going in a different direction, which lowers the chance. In other words, by the righteous person, it lowers the chance of sinning. Because as he develops, and as he deals, first of all, as he thinks correctly about life, starts making correct decisions. In other words, Mishlei is really a developmental book. It's not the ultimate tzaddik. Sometimes it talks about the ultimate tzaddik to give direction. But many times it's talking about the road towards righteousness. And according to these commentaries where it says, once sin causes another, it means that every time you do a sinful act, you become attached to that. And then you do it again and again. And then you take step by step a further and further away from the righteous road. Rashi says that a person could take one step until he could worship idolatry. In other words, that the Yetzer Hara works very, very slowly. It's very hard to take big jumps. But it's very easy to take a small step. And once you take that small step, then the next step, then the next step, then the next step. You're going in a different direction where the situations that come up where you would have early in your life not fallen into that type of situation, as you make decisions, you can start doing what you never thought you could do. Every human being in this room, every human being in the world, can develop an evil as he takes steps. On the other hand, the righteous person, as he takes steps towards reality and towards truth and towards the understanding, it's a step by step, it's a development. Whether you'll ever reach the conclusion that you'll be perfect, that's a couple of people that the Torah seems to mention in the five books. But afterwards, very few people perfected themselves, you understand, completely. That's a rarity. But however, you're just going in a certain direction where the probability of you falling into sin becomes less and less. There becomes more situations that you could deal with rationally than emotionally. In other words, when you start out in life, you start out dealing emotionally with life. But as you start thinking about it, so there becomes less situations. Then as you start dealing with the emotions that don't affect you so much, so it becomes more situations where you could deal correctly. You're moving in a certain direction, while the wicked person is moving in the opposite direction, so there's more situations which he could fall into sin. And the question is, if we're moving, if the Pasuk is talking about going it's a process, then why does he say there will not befall a righteous man any iniquity? You see? Why does it just say it will not befall a righteous man iniquity? But why does it say any iniquity? It seems to be that there'll be no iniquity. We're in Mishlei chapter 12, verse 22, and it says like this. It's an abomination of God, false speech. And he who does truth is his will. The first point is that toavas, or abomination, is the opposite of his will, of God's will. Those are opposites. The question is, what is abomination and what is his will? Since we can't know anything about God, we can only know God's actions. So the question is what is an abomination and what is his will? And the next thing, what does it mean doing truth? You don't do truth, you know truth. You act out based on the truth, but it says, Ose emuna, he who does truth. We find that wherever it says abomination, it means that the consequences are not immediate, are not immediately connected. In other words, like this. Let's say, for instance, when you smoke, so the consequences is you get heart disease, emphysema, cancer, okay? So there's a direct link between the between that and the between the smoking and the disease. But however, let's say, for instance, like by Noah, it was an abomination to God. It was an abomination to God when the people of the time of the flood, before the flood, that they had incest, okay, and there was total promiscuity. But then when he destroyed the nation, it was because there was a violence in the land. Okay, so there were two stages. And the Ramban says that the Ramban there says in Bereshis that that the promiscuity doesn't cause destruction of life. There's no direct link between promiscuity and destruction. Okay? But promiscuity, and the reason why the Torah prohibits promiscuity is because it leads to a freedom which leads to violence, and it's the violence that leads to destruction of society. So therefore, over there, they use the term abomination of God. So you see that there is two steps that's not noticeable. Sometimes the first step and the last step is not noticeable that there is a connection. You see? And so therefore, that's where they use the term abomination. And the opposite would be his will. Based on that introduction, the question is, what is the Pasuk talking about? The question is, what's the correlation between promiscuity, sexual promiscuity, and violence? How does one lead to the other? So the question is how does it work that one leads to the other? Okay, the answer is like this: that we see if you look around in society, the two biggest things, like if you watch TV, the two biggest things that sell is sex and violence. Okay, so we see they're very, very powerful emotions that the world gets involved in. I'm not saying there aren't others. But these are two very powerful emotions, okay? Two powerful drives, okay? Sex and aggression, all right? Now, what controls both of them is the conscience. What controls both of them is the conscience. Now, once you give license to the conscience in one area, then the other area of the conscience will be lifted. In other words, the conscience is not lifted from one place or another. When you remove the conscience, you're removing the conscience that's allowed freedom for the unconscious desires to come forward. You see? In other words, like this. When I was a kid, there was a saying, if you give a finger, they take a whole hand. What does it mean? There are many times when raising children, But when they're raising children, so sometimes the child wants something. If you give a little bit, then usually the child demands more. That was the idea with in Egypt, that Paro said that the people want freedom. You see, they're thinking of freedom. So I'll give them, so they have time to think of freedom, so I'll make it worse for them. Not only won't I give them the straw, they have to collect the straw, and they still have to make the same amount of bricks. You see? In other words, he knew that idea that if there's a certain leniency in one spot, it grows, you demand more the next. That's the way the conscience works. Once you give in on the conscience, there is a danger that it's going to be lifted and you can move further and further away from control to the desires of the animalistic part of you. At the beginning, when a nation starts out, there's practicality. So the practicality takes care of most of their energy is dealing, like the pioneers in the United States. They're building something and they're working for something, and they have a lot of need for practicality. But once the practicality passes, then there's more time. It's more time they start looking for leisure things. As they start removing the conscience, if their leisure starts leading to removing of the conscience and the freedoms in areas that were in control, slowly but surely the society as a whole, I'm not saying every person in the society, but the society as a whole starts going down until that's the way societies are destroyed, because there's no more control in the society. They just lose out. We're in Mishlei, Perek, chapter Yidbet, 12, verse 24. It says, the hand of the diligent will rule, and those that remain sneaky in cheating, will be as a servant. It says Lamas. Lamas means a tributary or for tax. In other words, you'll be subservient unto others. That's the pasuk. What are the questions? For Ramiya, we can read a deceit. In other words, it's sneaky. There'll be Lamas for a... one translation is a melt, which is also possible. In other words, it'll be destroyed or it'll be subservient. Okay? In other words, the diligent will rule and the deceitful person will be subservient under the diligent. Okay, the first question that was asked was, why would the diligent rule? Okay. But the thing is, the question that we have to ask is that there's no opposites. In other words, the opposite of diligent is lazy, and the opposite of deceitful is honest. The opposite of diligent is lazy. The opposite of deceitful is honest. So the question is, what is the subject of the pasuk? Deidre wants to say that really the pasuk is diligent, okay? But however, if you're going to be lazy, like for instance, let's say you don't want to do your homework and you don't want to study for a test, so then the only way of passing is by cheating, you see? In other words, he makes up, a lazy person has to make up what he needs in reality, has to make up by being deceitful. Okay? So therefore we're talking about, so he makes it up by being deceitful. What the pasuk is saying, that deceit will not make it up. He'll still be a failure. Okay? The question is, why? I mean, I could be deceitful, and maybe I can make it up. And I have been through the seed. I'll pass my tests or whatever it needs. At work, I'll work it out. But however I cheat, whichever way I cheat, to make up for my laziness, the pasuk says that he will fail. He'll fail to the diligent. But the question is why? Maybe he could make it. Why does he have to fail? Why is it necessity that the lazy person, when he tries to make up for his laziness, will fail, and that will not help? I'd like to ask one question before we answer this, and that is when you say diligent, can you be diligent without wisdom? That's the question. In other words, when you say diligent without wisdom, let's say, for instance, Hitler was very diligent in his war efforts, you see. Now, the thing is, but he was not diligent. He did not investigate whether he should go to war. You understand? So the thing is that can you be diligent? I mean, he was, in other words, in the strategy, he was smart in the war. Or his generals were, whatever it was. But the thing is that he was not wise. Okay? I want to know, can you be diligent without wisdom? That's what I want to know. Right, once again, can you be diligent without wisdom? That's the question. And the possibility that's being given is, let's say, a person that doesn't know anything about farming decides to farm. Now, he could be diligent in his farming, even though he doesn't know anything about farming, which means that he will not get the results that he wants, even with his diligence. In other words, he doesn't know how deep to plant it, how many rows he should make, how far the rows should be from each other. If you don't know that, then working hard, you will not get the results. Usually diligent, the way we use diligent is that you will get your results. Not that you do something stupid energetically. That is not usually associated with diligent. I mean, diligent, that way diligent will lead to total failure. Diligent person could lead to failure. That's not usually the way they look at diligent. But even if you want to make that distinction, that there's two types of diligent people, then again, so I'll ask you the question, which is better, a wise diligent or an unwise diligent person? So we're saying, we'll use the term diligent for a wise person, and we'll say that diligent means that the wise person knows what he should do and exactly how he should do it. That's the diligent person. It must take a certain amount of wisdom. Can't be without wisdom, okay, the diligent, okay? So therefore, the thing is that in everyday life, when you're trying to work correctly, then there's going to be ways of working it out. You're going to have to find exactly how to do it. In other words, let's take the case of the farmer, how deep to cut, to till the land, how far apart the rows should be, how often could you do it in a season. In other words, you must have this knowledge. The lazy person is going to try, we're talking about cheating. We're not talking about the way he does the correct thing. That's another pasuk. But the thing is that we're talking about where he cheats. He only gets results, which means that he really is not a thinker. Thinking is also takes a certain amount of diligence. It's part of diligence to be a thinker. So therefore, in his cheating, he's going to make mistakes. He could go so far, but his laziness will stop him from moving ahead. His laziness will not allow him to work through, not to get caught completely, but at a certain point he will make mistakes. So therefore his whole, like you said, attitude, that was a good word, his whole attitude is towards avoiding work and only finding shortcuts. Those shortcuts will be terribly destructive because he will not think it through. While the diligent person, using his wisdom, will be successful in all areas. Now, the question was that the ant is diligent and it doesn't have any wisdom. That's true. It doesn't have any conscious wisdom, but it has God's wisdom. God creates within the ant to do the things correctly, and they work together as a unit correctly, despite the fact that they don't have a leader. Each one knows their job, but that is innately created in them by God. That's God's wisdom. Okay? But to be successful, you must have wisdom. It's not their wisdom, it's God's wisdom that God created them to be diligent, and God created them to do the correct thing. So it's God's wisdom that makes the ant successful. The question is, what type of wisdom I'm talking about? I'm talking about any type of knowledge or wisdom that is necessary to be successful in your project, whatever is necessary to be successful. Like, for instance, Hitler was not diligent to check out whether war is of value. He was not diligent in that. He was diligent in carrying out the war effort. But he was not diligent in investigating his emotions. That was a big mistake. That's why he failed, because he did an erroneous act. But we're not talking about that type of laziness. We're not talking about, that's true, we're not talking about that type of laziness in this pasuk. This pasuk, we're just talking about the laziness that comes about, that I don't want to do work and I just want the results of everyday life. So I must know about how to work, and all the problems that occur at work. Through the years, you work out different problems. The diligent person will work out different problems, and he will remove them, okay? But the lazy person just bypasses it and doesn't work out any problems, so he's the same old person that he was after 10 years, and after a while, he's just going to fail. There's a certain amount of knowledge that you can get beforehand. There's a certain amount of knowledge that you get through experience. So the diligent person that got the knowledge beforehand that was necessary, so then when he makes mistakes in experience, so he'll think about it and work it through and straighten it out. So he will constantly get better at his job. The lazy person, every time there's the problem, he tries to cheat somehow, or deceitful, or whatever, however he works it out. But he doesn't deal with the problem. So he never learns. Even on the job, he does not learn. In other words, Hitler dealt with one type of success, namely the war effort. But he did not see the problems based on that. If you don't understand about yourself, how your own emotions could destroy you in the long run. That he did not see. So that also destroys him. But that is not what, that aspect of laziness, the pasuk is not talking about. The pasuk is talking about the laziness that you can't even work out, that you can't work out the laziness, you can't work out the problem of just the job itself, not the basic premises of how to live life, that's what Hitler was missing. But I'm saying that people are too lazy to work out the problems of life. That's what the pasuk is talking about. It is true that you will be, if you cheat, you will be successful on the short run. In other words, you will be successful. But after a while, the knowledge that you missed out on through living life will catch up to you. In other words, let's say you cheat on your tests. So then you might need that knowledge in business. Somebody that didn't cheat on the test will have that knowledge in business, be more successful than you are. The experiences of life that a person has learns from experience of life, and he changes the way he operates because of his experience, will develop. He's losing out on that development. So if he's losing out at that development, at a certain point, he will totally lose out. But however, on the short run, he can be successful. In other words, when a person... Yeah, I understand. The thing is that the question is, the person that's constantly learning from his mistakes and straightening out. 10 years after he goes out from high school, he cheated through high school, he cheated through college, and he cheated through in business as much as he can. and he got away with it. And the person that worked through all classes in high school, worked through all classes in college, and then worked out wherever he made mistakes, what is the probability of which one failing based on their knowledge of their business, of their trade, or about life itself? What is the probability in 10 years of the diligent person failing, and what is the probability of the lazy person or the deceitful person failing? In other words, there's no guarantees in this life, but we're just saying based on probability. Again, we're not talking about a person that's diligent at work, like a Hitler or a mafia, where they're diligent at their work, but they don't know the basic premises. That's a different problem. We're talking about they cheat because of their laziness. That was the puzzle. Right. But I'm saying they can be successful for a certain amount of years, and then they will fail. Okay, that's all I'm saying. I'm not talking about the other kind. The other kind is a different problem. We'll have to discuss that another time. The other type of person we'll have to discuss at another time. You understand how they fail. Okay. This is chapter 12 in Proverbs, verse 25, and it says, "Worry in the heart of a man will break him, and a good thing will make him happy." Once again, worry in the heart of man will break him, and something good will make him happy. The first question is what is the second half doing here with the first half? What all the commentaries say is the second half says that which will remove, it's not being happy like a positive thing, you go out to a party. It means that which will remove the, by happy, it means remove the worry. Alright? So it says, worry in the heart of man will destroy him, but there is something good which will remove the worry. The question is the worry bad? Okay? The answer is that worry destroy, when you're under stress, that always, the Torah always holds that shortens your life. I mean, I've seen in the Rambam and the Ibn Ezra that stress takes away from life.
Now I find it.
So the question is, what is that something good? Okay, that's the question. There are different commentaries, and there's around six ways you could cure from all the commentaries. There are about six ways that you could cure your stress. Okay? Are you ready? Okay. First thing is to recognize that this world is really valueless. Okay? In other words, like this. Like people, they say that the highest level of humility comes from people that study astronomy. Okay? Now, when you study the universe and you see the vastness of the universe, you realize that what could you accomplish? What is there that could happen? You understand that's a catastrophe. You understand? I mean, your life is short. You live your life, and that's it. That's it. Well, just know what to do. All you could do is correct actions. Okay? That's it. There's nothing there. There's nothing to accomplish in life. Is only to do correct actions and enjoy what you have, the best possible life, by removing conflict like we're doing now. That's the best thing you could do for yourself. You have to realize that whatever happens to you is for just a short time. It passes. You understand? That's it. There's nothing. When you look in the scheme of the universe, in the evolutionary process, if you look through the evolutionary process, if you look through the evolutionary process and the scheme of things, in the 12, I think now they say that the world is 12 billion years old. The 12 billion years, so our time is very limited. Even the species itself is very limited. 6,000 years of civilization is a very small part of the whole picture. You understand? When you look at the whole picture, there's so from the universe, from evolution, from every different aspect, what's the big deal? The main thing is something goes wrong. So, all right, so it went wrong. So what? Okay, so something went wrong. Whatever you're worried about, it's nothing very big. It's only big because the person feels that he's very important, and these things, these little things that bother him, shouldn't be there. It shouldn't be there. So you make a big thing out of it. But the truth is, in the scheme of things, if you look at the overall picture, you know, early on this tape, I made a distinction between how people look at life. Some people look at life from what they're experiencing, and one person looks at life from the overall picture. If you look at life from the way you're experiencing it, then every single thing, every time you're bothered, something goes wrong, you're unhappy. Every time something good happens, so you're happy. So it's dependent on everything outside of you, how it affects you. But the truth is, a person has to learn how, it's not easy, but a person has to learn how to look at life from the overall picture. And the overall picture in the scheme of things, if you look at the universe, at the vastness of the universe, I mean, you're just like nothing more than a piece of sand. And if you look at it from the evolutionary process, the whole human race is only around 6,000 years old in 12 billion years. What is it? What's so important about us? What's so important that every single thing is like a catastrophe? The answer is because we make decisions based on how we experience things, not on the overall picture. The question is what you might break. You understand? You think you're a nothing, so you might break. No, there's two reasons why you think you're a nothing. Okay? One is a bad self-image means that you demand of yourself a very, very high level of whatever you demand of yourself, whatever you demand of success. Whether it's sports, education, and business, in comparison to others, you demand a very high of yourself. And when you don't live up to what you created in your mind, that is a bad self-image. So bad self-image comes, the very bad self-image comes from a bad evaluation, what you demand of yourself. You understand? But however, here we're saying not from what you demand, an unconscious thing, an irrational demand of yourself. We're just saying, look at the truth, and there's nothing more than living the correct life. That's it. If you make a mistake, that's why we have the tshuva. You repent. That's it. Nothing to go crazy about. Nothing to be depressed about. Just move on. Just keep on going. Work it out. In other words, if he's not living up to his own expectations, he creates certain expectations of himself, and he can't live up to those expectations, so when he doesn't, he has a bad self-image. In other words, if you think you know, if you come through knowledge, through study, there's a certain feeling that I'm nothing more than a grain of sand, you know what I mean, or nothing more than a herd of animals, I'm just part of the herd. You understand? There's no importance to me. That's not a bad self-image. That's recognizing yourself via reality. In other words, the first is an inner experience. You're not even aware of it. It's just a certain feeling that I feel great, I feel bad, and that's all that matters is the feeling. And you just, whatever your personality drives you, it drives you one way or the other. You understand? But if you look at the overall picture, so then it's just the sense of reality tells you that there is no value in being depressed. There's just enjoy life. You make a mistake, true, there are problems, so straighten it out. That's it. Okay? So, but there's no bad self-image as a result of that. On the contrary, it gives you a certain amount of freedom. It'll give you freedom. It'll give you a freedom to not to be stuck in all these petty little things that happen in everyday life, that they'll just go by you without even being aware of it. It doesn't bother you when you start seeing the world correctly. And the question is how do you move from the bad self-image to, well, let's put it this way, how do you move from deciding everything based on how you feel at the moment to an overall picture? That comes through study.
Okay.
It's a slow process. You might not reach very high levels, but whatever you reach, it'll make life easier. And that's the direction to go. I mean, even studying like Mishlei and even that will help you, guide you in different ways. We'll soon see we have around 5 other ways of helping you get rid of stress. But the thing is that this is probably one of the harder ones. Okay, it is probably one of the harder ones. I mean, it's a longer thing. I'm not saying this in any order. This happens to be the commentary of the Meiri. Okay. And so there are different commentaries, and we'll come across the Meiri again, another hard one that he has. He seems to have the difficult ones, but there are other ones that are much easier. Okay, but it's good to know all of them and use the long term ones. You know, to figure out a plan to work on the long term ones, and the short term ones you could start working out quickly. Okay. When I said there are two ways that you feel you are nothing, one is the incorrect way and one is the correct way. One is a foolish way and one is a wise and intelligent way, which take a lot of years of study to reach that.
Okay.
The question is that if there's no value in life, so why don't I have an eat, drink, and be merry attitude? Okay? That is the question. Or do whatever I feel like. The answer is that because that will lead you away from wisdom, which will lead you into a world of worry. It'll lead you into the world of particulars. If you're left in the world of particulars, then you start relate. In other words, you're training yourself to relate by how you feel at the moment. I'm eating, I'm drinking, I'm happy, that's it. You know what I mean? I'm partying, that's it. So it's training you in the opposite direction, which will give you a life of worry, and definitely throughout the book, I mean, of Mishlei, we see all the consequences that come from that life. But because you deal with the particulars and you're not training in the world of thought, then you will get all the worries that the world has to offer. In other words, I'm saying that it'll just tell you to look for the best possible life that you can have. Okay? Now, the best possible life is the life of Torah in the short time. And we're just telling you one more way that you could avoid having worry. I mean, there are many other benefits of this. I mean, humility will bring you close to God. I mean, all these things, I mean, humility brings a tremendous amount of benefits. We're just talking about one aspect. Next one is given by Rashi. He says, sit down and study Torah. Okay? In other words, many times when you have a worry, there are two types of worries. There is the impractical and the practical. Okay? Impractical, you got to see that it's impractical. Practical, you have to stop worrying so you can think about it, right? So he says, get involved, forget about the problem for a minute. Get involved in an idea. An idea will take away, when you get involved in study, have a good area, tape or a book or a good problem that you want to think about, get involved. Just forget about it. The problem will still be there in 20 minutes and a half hour. Okay? Don't worry about it. It'll still be there. You won't forget it. But so therefore, just forget it for the moment. Then when you stop studying, then you'll have a different perspective. You'll come out in a different perspective and you won't have the worry and you'll say, okay, now what should I do about it? It gives you a different, it takes away the edge off the worry for long enough time to be able to come back and think about it clearly. And the Torah itself gives you, like you get involved in the world of ideas, so then you come back and you approach it, it reminds you to approach it from the world of ideas, and worry is not going to help. In other words, if you have a small worry and you can think correctly, then fine. Then just get involved with the problem, deal with the problem, and that's it. But however, if it bothers you so much that you can't concentrate, just forcing you to concentrate is not going to help. It can't help. It just makes things worse. The best thing is to pull out. Okay? The question is, what is worry? Okay, there's two times, like I said just before, there are two levels. One level is where you're upset, something is bothering you, but fine, you could work it out clearly. You know what I mean? You could sit down and work it out clearly. Then I would say, I wouldn't worry about that worry. Okay? Okay. I wouldn't worry, I wouldn't add another worry to myself with that one. But however, if when you get out of control, when the stress is killing you, where it's a constant thing, like people in business, like the stress is unbelievable, or sometimes a mother that's in the house all day with children and she has to get out. And sometimes it's just good to get out. I mean, that's a very simple practice, and that's the practical solution. But sometimes it's just get your mind on thought, and you're able to forget about it and get your mind on thought, so you're attached to thought, and then when you come back, so you're able to think it through. It's hard to define worry because, I mean, it's a certain experience that you're having. Okay? The cause of it is different things. The cause is different things. I mean, you're afraid you're going to lose your money, your children are not going to grow up right. I mean, there's all different types of things that causes you this type of stress.
So the root then.
Cal wants to say that the cause of stress and the cause of worry and the cause of depression is fear. It's brought about by fear. Okay? That you're afraid of something. You're either afraid of something you did in the past, you're afraid of something that will happen in the future. So these are all these are all type of fears. In other words, worry of the past is where we remember things from the past, in other words, the old emotion is awakened again. You understand? Whatever the emotion is, and the emotion is awakened again, whatever happened at that time. But however, in the future, the fear is some type of consequence. Some catastrophe that could happen to you. Okay, so I think that's what it is. There's a fear that's brought up by memory. By memory of a certain thing that created a certain fear in you. And then there's a fear of the future, which is more of a practical fear. Practical that what's going to go wrong. In other words, the question is, can you go back to the first one in a time of worry, just compare it to yourself, to the universe? I don't think that would work. I think it has to be that it's part of your emotions that you are. It's not an intellectual thing. It has to be part of your nature that you feel that, what could I accomplish in life? What is there that I'm losing? You understand? And so that has to come through study and through years. Your personality is affected. And your emotions is affected. Study of Torah is an immediate thing. or getting out of the situation, sometimes just a break, getting out of the situation, that's an immediate thing, help for the problem. The best is Torah, because Torah, through study, you can get your mind into something. You go totally above the problem. And it says the lips are forever, and in a moment, and up until a moment, the words of a falsehood. In other words, the verse is saying is that the truth is firm forever, while somebody speaks false, only lasts about a moment. The first question is that sometimes you could talk about somebody, and the effects are very long. Second question is, what does it mean about the firm, that it's firm? Firm means established, that it will stay. Forever. In other words, it's firm means that it's established forever. As far as the first question is concerned, I don't think the pasuk is talking about the effects of the whatever's being said, but the fact itself. It's talking about the information itself, that truth stands forever and falsehood only lasts for a while. The question is, what type of truths are we talking about? Are we talking about truth that I say something about another person that's true or false? Or are we talking about ideas that are true or false? The question is, what is the subject of the verse? It can't be truth about people or particulars, because particulars come and go. They're definitely lost. A person, definition. Understanding of a person, psychological. So we're talking about ideas, okay? Ideas itself. But we're talking about ideas, and a truth. The truth cannot. In other words, if somebody has a false idea, that a false idea must lead to one of two things. It either leads to consequences, or it leads to a contradiction, or both. It should be both. So therefore, if it's purely an idea and there is no contradiction, if it's false, then you will find a contradiction with it. Or if it has to do with life, then you will find consequences with that false idea. Any false idea, there will be consequences and there will be contradictions. Therefore, the truth, the truth is that which has no contradiction and no consequences. So therefore, that is the truth. That means it'll exist forever, while the other one will be only last for a moment until you see the contradiction or the consequence of that statement. Okay, we're doing verse 20. Right? Agree in the heart of those that plow evil. Interesting language, plow evil. And the advisors of peace is simplest happiness. Angry or deceit is in the heart of those that plow evil. And to advisors of peace is happiness. The question is that there are a lot of good people that fail, and there are a lot of evil people that are successful. Okay, so the question is, it seems to be contrary to what the facts of the world seem to be contrary to the pasuk. Rabbah has two answers to this verse. The first answer, what does it mean to plow evil? To plow evil means that the person thinks about doing harm. Okay? there are those people that, that, in other words, you have to be careful here. There are people, everybody is born, according to the Torah, it says, Pera Adam Yulad, a person is born wild. The basic drives of a human being is that they think evil, that they desire evil. But however, through development and through ideas, people can change. But however, we're not talking about a person the way he's born, but where he develops towards his evil, where he starts developing and thinking and devoting time to thought about harming people. That's what it means in the, he plows. In other words, he thinks it through, goes into the depth how to fool people, how to trick people. Certain people that do bad, you know, they don't think about it. They get caught. They don't get caught. It's all chance. This guy is, what the verse is talking about is a person that really stops to think about evil. It's not all evil people the verse is talking about. It's talking about one type of person. A person that thinks about how come others, for whatever reason, whether it's for profits, for vengeance, for jealousy, whatever the motive, the verse doesn't talk about motive, but when a person thinks about harming others, there's certain people that really think it through to try to harm others. The Ralbach says that they try also to harm the righteous people, and the righteous people, he says, those that advise peace, they will be able to figure out what the evil person is thinking, and therefore will be able to protect themselves against the evil person. Now the question is, what is the advisors of peace? What quality do they have that they will be able to recognize and to see what the evil person is thinking? The question is the pasuk could have, this is a side point, I mean, the pasuk could have said something more open in the sense that they, that the wise person knows what he's, what the fool is thinking, what the wicked person or the tricky person is out. Well, it could have been more open about the depth of the thought that he thinks deeply. Why does it go with the metaphor? So that is the question. Okay, the answer is in Proverbs in general. Part of Proverbs is not only to teach you the morals and ethics of how to live life, what is the best life, but to have that life, you must be a thinker. And so therefore, they wrote the book in such a way that to get to the ideas, you must ask questions, and the better the question, the better the guide to the, depending what questions you ask, that's what you're going to look at. If the questions are not good, it could take you away. The question is, how do you know when you're interpreting right or wrong? The answer is when there is no more questions. That's what we said before. If there's the last verse, verse 19, we said that the falsehoods have contradictions or they have consequences. And so therefore, if you see any consequences or contradictions, to the best thing is the contradiction, which that's the way we operate in class. I mean, we say something and then we ask contradictions. There's a contradiction, then we have to straighten it out. So therefore, when there are no more contradictions, then you have to accept whatever results you came to must be the truth. Saying that nobody naturally would have asked questions on the verse, people usually just read it. That is correct. And therefore, there are a few people on their own that would ask questions, and natural thinkers. And two, therefore, we have a system of teachers and students, and that it's very important, the idea of education in Torah, so that it's to open your mind that how to ask the question, and that there are questions, that you should be free to ask these questions so that you can develop your mind and your thinking process. The question that we're dealing with is where it says the advisors of peace, they will be simcha, meaning that they'll be happy, meaning that they'll be able to overcome the evil. The question is, what does advisors of peace have to do with recognizing what's in the mind of the evil person, and so he could be able to protect himself from that? Council of peace means that they try to work out situations that there shouldn't be any conflict. To work out situations that there's no conflict, you must understand human nature and how to hide the surface of the human being to be able to advise him in a correct manner. Okay, like for instance, I'll give you an example. It says that Aaron was a lover of peace and he ran after peace. So they say, what does it mean that he ran after peace? He would go to one person and says, hey, you know, your friend wants to make up with you, but he feels a little embarrassed. Then he goes to the other person and says, your friend wants to make up with you, and he feels a little embarrassed. So when they come together, they would say, they would get together and give each other, Now the thing is, the question is that when you're angry, if you say your friend wants to make up with you, at the moment of anger, you're going to say, to heck with him, you see? So the question is, what is Aaron talking about? Well, what is the sages talking about when they bring the story? Okay? The answer is that there's two stages in anger. One is, I am angry with you, and then I have to admit that I'm wrong. So the first thing, I'm angry with you, then you can't talk to the person that's angry. But once the anger is passed, then what's stopping him is his ego, because he doesn't want to admit he's wrong. So he keeps up the front that, no, I'm still angry with him. But as soon as the other person realizes that the other guy wants to make up, so then he feels good. Oh, if he wants to make up, then fine, then I'll make up with him. That means he realizes he's wrong. And that's what the other guy, so then they would get together. They'd feel okay and start to talk to each other. Okay? Now, the question is, that Deidre just asked, is what about if one person is really wrong? One person is really wrong, then is really wronged, then he still has his anger, so you can't talk to him. In other words, my understanding of that chazal, of those sages telling about Aaron, is that they're saying, not at a moment of anger. A moment of anger could be for years, depending. If it's anger, then I don't know if you could overcome it. If it's the ego, then it's just a matter of appeasing the ego so that the person could relate. So therefore, you have to understand psychology to make peace. You have to understand at what point you could talk to a person, what situation you could talk to the person, at what point you can't talk to the person, and what situation you cannot talk to the person. So therefore, a person of peace must have knowledge of the psyche and the psychology of the human being so that he could speak to him and make that peace. So the advisors of peace, when they look at the wicked person, they also understand from his actions and the way he talks, they could define what his motive is and what his nature is. And when they do that, so then they know to have to protect themselves from these type of people. The question is, what if somebody is wrong? Let's take an evil person and a righteous person. An evil person is really wrong and he has to be punished. That's not out of anger. That's not out of vengeance. It's a matter of justice. Okay? Most arguments that I have seen, that I'm aware of, it's simply based on even if one is right and one is wrong, it has nothing to do with right or wrong. The argument is based on anger and then the ego maintaining that status quo of not being friends. That's most arguments that I've seen. people try to raise it to a level of justice where each person claims that they're right. If it was both justice, then they'd have a discussion like we have about a pasuk. It's just a matter of a discussion to straighten out which one is right. Somebody should be able to prove they're right or wrong. That's it. If it's a matter of truth, then one of them, through questioning and argumentation, they should be able to prove who's right and who's wrong. But most cases, it's not like that. Most cases, you can't talk to the person. If it was a search for truth, then the two people will argue and they would straighten it out. But however, most people are only interested in either their anger or their ego, and so therefore you have to deal with the emotions of the person and not with the rationale. The emotional situation, you must know. And so therefore, if you know the emotional makeup of a human being to help straighten them out, you'll also have the emotional, you'll also have the knowledge of the emotional makeup and the decisions of the evil by listening carefully to the way they speak or act and start understanding their nature and what they're capable of. So then is why the advisors... The question that's being asked is, why is it that we have to commemorate a certain event? So we spend, like Pesach, we spend the whole week commemorating an event. I mean, that's a little overdoing it. And where do we get the facts that we should commemorate these? But where we get the facts, simple, we get it from Torah, basically. The difference of one day or 2 days, that's midrabbanan. The sages tell us that we should have 2 days instead of 1 day, which is a totally separate question, why we do that, okay? But the main question that I'd like to discuss today is why commemoration commemoration of these events. Well, what does it help to commemorate events? So I know a fact we got out of Egypt. What benefit is it to commemorate that event? Okay? When you read through the Talmud, you see the Talmud is a very, very rational system. Very rational. I mean, just to learn how to read the Gemara, forget about language. Let's say you knew Hebrew and Aramaic. When you know how to prepare Gemara on your own, it's not only that you gained language, but it's a development of the mind. The development of the mind is the Gemara's deduction, and the way they wrote it, they don't write it like you read a magazine. There's nothing that you have to work out. But the Gemara is so written that you have to abstract ideas. So you're learning deduction. That's the fact that you will get. And the way you get it, the way the words are written, you have to abstract from the words all this deduction from the Gemara. So abstraction is it's called induction. So you're learning. So Simon, if you know how to make a laning, laning means to learn Gemara on your own. We're able to read, translate, and explain the question, the answer, and the sequence. The mind has been trained on these two principles of the mind. Okay? Deduction and induction. Okay? Now, and when you read the commentaries on the other parts of Torah, the Hashkafa, part or the philosophy part of Torah, you read the different commentaries, you see that you see also an intellectual approach and ideas in their whole method of writing and their method of writing and the ideas that they write. You see it's all an intellectual thing, okay? What do you mean religion? If it's of the mind, then it should be a philosophy. What makes it a religion is that God obligated us to do these actions, and we're following God. That's what makes it a religion. Because we are obeying God, that defines religion, when you follow God. So it's a religion. Now the question is, why did God set it up this way? Okay? Alright, now I'd like to give one introduction to this. If you don't like my reason, you still have to obey God. This is not a proof that you have to obey God. In other words, I have the right to try to understand what is the benefit. I don't know why God wrote the Torah. I don't know why God does anything. That we said this many times, that we cannot understand why God did anything, why God created the world, why he should relate to us. We can't answer that. That has to do with the nature of God, which we cannot understand. But we can analyze a benefit. That's the different commentaries, why they have different approaches, because they look at it differently of what the benefit of all the things are. So I have the right to find the benefit of why God made things this way. So why did God set up an intellectual system as a religion? Why didn't he just set it up as a philosophy? Why did he set it up as a religion? The answer is because we are basically, when we start out in life, we're very emotional, and we tend to attach to the emotional. So God set up a religious system where you start off relating in an emotional way. As you see, throughout the world, religion is a very, very strong, a powerful emotion. Okay? Throughout the world. So you see, human beings have a strong conviction about religion and attachment to religion, and they try to live the life of their religion. So therefore, God set up a system where you relate to the system because of emotional reasons, but as a result of those emotional reasons, you start studying the Torah, which is ideas, and it slowly but surely, it takes you out of that emotional realm and brings you into the realm of ideas. So the purpose of the religion is to take you from the world of emotions into the world of ideas. Now let's take Pesach, okay? Your question, okay? So Pesach represents the change from the nation of Israel as a nation, as any other nation, to a nation that has a close tie to God, where God will deal with this nation in particular and relate to them through crime and punishment. That God, in other words, the world was created through the laws of nature. Sometimes God gets involved in crime and punishment. He will intervene in the laws of nature to punish or reward. But in particular, and to the greatest extent, is to the nation of Israel. Okay? So therefore, in general, I mean, you could ask all questions, why do we do it in the matter, like the Seder, we do the Seder night, different things. We do it in different ways. Each thing, we could see the idea that it represents. So therefore, when I attach to my religion and I keep my holidays, suddenly I start asking questions, like your question. Why should I keep 7 days to represent one event? And the answer is, because God wants you to spend 7 days involved in the ideas of Pesach. And that should carry you, it doesn't mean you can't think about it the rest of the year, but it reawakens the idea. You come back to the idea because of the religious command. You come back to the idea and go into more depth and investigate it more, see it from different angles, different aspects. I mean, if you just look at first of all, the thinking is in the halacha. There's the halacha of Yontif in general, holiday in general. Then there's the weekday part of the holidays. All the laws that pertain to that, that's one type of investigation. Then there's the philosophy behind it, like I mentioned, that it's not only freedom, physical freedom, but it's a relationship to God, which is a different definition of freedom. And then the Seder night represents education, which is the method of finding this freedom. You understand? So therefore, there is many ideas in Pesach that every year you have to come back to it and reawaken all the different ideas, and you go deeper and deeper in the relationship between God and Israel in that investigation. You see? So therefore, that is the purpose of all the mitzvos. All the mitzvos, first of all, is the training of the mind, because there's the halachic investigation, the different questions that you have on laws and the nature of the laws and how it works and that. And then there's the philosophical ideas behind the mitzvos, which represents a different type of view of the same mitzvos. And in that way, all the mitzvos lead you to one thing, to the world, to a world of ideas and a world of thought and investigation. You see, that is the purpose of all the mitzvos. And you asked in particular about Pesach or about the different holidays, so therefore I explained the drop step in that area. What I'm telling you, all the mitzvos is for the purpose of learning and investigation and training the mind to think straight, and that is the purpose of Torah. The question is Chol HaMoed. Chol HaMoed is the weekday between the two, between the holidays. In other words, like this. Pesach and Sukkot. It happens on Pesach and Sukkot. Okay? Let's take Pesach. Pesach has 7 days according to the Torah. The first day is a Yom Tov. The last day is a Yom Tov. And the five in between is Chol HaMoed. It's part weekday and part holiday. It has both in it. Now, the question is, why did God create such a situation? Chol HaMoed, I'll just give a possibility, but I'm not sure if I don't have any proof for it, but it could be it's a benefit why it happens. In other words, it could be that God felt that the idea of Pesach and Sukkot needs more than a day or two of thought to really get the idea. Get the idea, you need like many days. But you can't make 7 days Yantav. People have to, you know, you can't. So therefore what God did, he says, I want you to really have 7 days of thought. I realize practically, it could be, I'm not sure if this is the reason, there might be a philosophical reason for the weekday part of the holiday. But it could be a practical reason. I really want you to spend 7 days in thought. But it's not possible. People have to take care of their business. You have to cook, you have to buy food. I mean, you know what I mean? So these things are not possible. It could be that it was practical that he made the first day Yantav and the last day Yantav. During the week, he had certain laws. When you're allowed to work, when you're not allowed to work, there's different laws. But you can do certain things to take care of the practical, but still. Therefore, so Chol HaMoed could have been a practical thing. You understand? Just to help, there could be a philosophical idea behind Chol HaMoed. I'm not aware of it. Okay? But I'm just saying it is possible that you have 7 days of thought about the idea of Pesach, and Sukkot too. So therefore he made 2 days Yantav and 5 days Chol HaMoed, but you should still be involved in the idea of Pesach. Okay, the question is why do sports fans get so attached to the players and the team? Okay? In other words, there are two ways in carrying out an act. In other words, there are two ways in carrying out an act psychologically. If I have a desire for a certain act, I could carry it out on my own. Or what I do, if I can't, so I identify with somebody else that is carrying out the act, and via him. Identification means that psychologically, when he and I are the same. There's a component where me and you are the same, so that when you carry out the act, it's equal to me carrying out the act. So when he does well, you feel good and excited and you cheer him on because it's as if you're doing it. And when he does wrong, then you get angry with him. You see? Why? See, if it was you, you're not going to get angry with yourself usually what people do when they make a mistake for themselves, when a person makes a mistake, he usually excuses himself. He says, I was in a bad mood, or something happened, something went wrong. They always have an excuse. When somebody else makes a mistake, then he's wrong. There's no excuse. Okay? Now, sometimes when you identify with the person, sometimes you so identify with him that you give excuses for him. And sometimes when you identify with the person, when he does something wrong, so instead of getting angry with yourself like you're doing something wrong, you carry it out on him. You carry out the anger on him, because that you can do, you see? So therefore, you're extremely attached to this star, because you want to be that star. Now, how you relate to him depends on your personality. You could relate to him that when he makes a mistake, you give an excuse, just like yourself. Or because you identify with him, but it is not you, so then when he's successful, then you feel good. It's as if you did it. When he makes a mistake, then you can't get angry with him. We're in the situation where you would not be angry with yourself. One of the students mentioned that he thinks that you identify with a star, with a superstar, because of envy. Okay? Now, it could be, yes, when you envy somebody or are jealous of somebody, there are two types of reactions. In other words, envy means I want to have it because that person has it, right? So therefore, I could have it by identifying with the person, and that person and I, in my unconscious, is equal, and despite reality that we're not, but unconscious is enough to satisfy, so I'm able to identify with him. Or, if I can't identify with him, then I hate him. You see? So the jealousy brings out the hatred. So there are people that you can be jealous of, and because of the jealousy, you identify with them, so you have it. Or you can't identify, so then you hate them. Okay? So I'm not disagreeing with the envy part, but I'm just saying the mechanism, the original question is, why do I love a superstar, is because I'm the identification, okay? But what causes you to want to identify? Yeah, there's different things. One of them could be envy. There might be other reasons. There's the famous question of God hardening Pharaoh's heart, okay, throughout the plagues. And the Abarbanel has around three answers, and I'd like to discuss his third answer. Okay? His third answer is, basically, that what God did was he gave him a plague, he felt pain, and he took it away. And he says there was no pain that was constant. Okay? And he says that if he wanted to force Pharaoh to do what he wanted to do, he would have just made the pain constant. But what he did is he gave him pain, took it away, gave him pain, took it away, and that was all 10 plagues. And he says there is no difference by the last five where it says that God hardened his heart. He says it's all the same. It's all the same. God did not harden his heart. Essentially, but while he hardened his heart, he made a play, took it away. Made a play, took it away. And he says also that when the Jews left and they're in the desert, he saw that they were nevuchim heim baretz. They were confused. God was taking him like a crisscross way, so it looked like confusion. You see. So it says that Paro hardened his heart, and he went after them. Okay? That is basically what the Abarbanel says. And my basic question that I'd like to ask, according to him, what is the definition of hardening of the heart, according to him? What is hardening of the heart? In other words, it's not that hardening of the heart is not adding any information. It's just I don't know what hardening of the heart means according to him. In other words, according to the usual interpretation, hardening of the heart is God did not allow Paro to repent. Didn't allow him to repent. He hardened his heart, didn't allow him to repent. Over here, what is hardening of the heart? I don't know the word, what it means, hardening of the heart. The first thing that we have to understand is that hardening of the heart is usually stubborn. And there's two types of stubbornness. There's psychological stubbornness, and then the Torah's view of stubbornness is where I refuse to accept reality. I refuse to accept the truth. Okay? So we are dealing with, when we call a person stubborn or hardening of the heart, we're talking about a person that does not accept truth or reality. Okay? Now, the question is, in other words, like this, there's two ways of seeing the world. Either I see the world the way I feel or experience the world, or I look objectively outside to the world. If I look at the world through my experience, then when I'm in pain, I have one experience and I view the world that way. When I'm not in pain, I view the world differently. In other words, each experience causes me to view life differently because I only look at that particular area, you see, but not the overall picture. So therefore, when God caused the plague, his view was that I better give in. When God took away the plague, his view was, why should I worry? I'm not in pain, because he was not experiencing it at that time. Now, I could understand that decision after the first two or three plagues, but after a while, you understand there's an overall picture here that you can get an overall picture. But that is the way the thinking person operates, by the overall picture. But by Paro, he only reacted based on each experience, and he couldn't get an overall picture of the whole thing. And therefore, when he saw them confused in the land, in the desert, he says, even though he could have looked at all 10 plagues and everything what happened and said, well, I don't understand this, why they're confused or something, but I better stay away, he immediately reacted based on his momentary experience, you see. So hardening of the heart is where I refuse to accept reality. And the reason why I refuse to accept reality is because I only act based on how I experience or how I feel about this momentary situation, but I do not look at the overall picture. By the way, you know, some people talk about that this world is a momentary pleasure, therefore you should give up the pleasures of this world and go for the world to come. I think momentary pleasure is because it's only the way you view the life, that right now it's a pleasure the way you're viewing it, but it might not really be a pleasure. That has to be evaluated. So it's a momentary pleasure, not because it's in the physical world, it's a momentary pleasure. It's a momentary pleasure because you relate to the pleasure only based on your momentary, at that moment's experience. But if you looked at the overall picture, then you would be able to see if it's really a pleasure or maybe it's not a pleasure. But that's the only way you could tell whether a thing is pleasurable or pain, when you look over the overall picture, but not the way you're experiencing it at this particular moment. A student asked me, you know, we have the other interpretation of hardening. hardening of the heart, where God actually hardens the heart. And in fact, this is the third explanation of the Abarbanel, and he has that other type in the first two, okay, of hardening of the heart. I mentioned I happen to like this answer very much. And they asked me, could I decide which one happened? In other words, could I make a decision in what I think, which one happened? That was the question that was asked. I'd like to answer the question like this. I can't make a decision between the Abarbanel. You know, they're all, these are great thinkers. But the thing is, I could identify with this answer more than the other one. I'll explain why. To understand when God essentially hardens the heart, he stops the person, he doesn't allow him to repent, I don't grasp that idea very well. Because there's certain basic knowledge that you have to have. The first thing is that you have to know there's varying degrees of evil. Like, for instance, let's say a person murders because he's robbing a store and he's going to get caught, and because he's going to get caught, he murders. And let's say there's another person that enjoys killing people, okay, and he murders. Which one would you say is more evil? So you're definitely going to say the one that enjoys it is more evil. Now, there are varying degrees, and you have to understand all the varying degrees and to explain why one degree is higher than another. There's many different types of cases. I don't think I have all the cases clear. Secondly, at that point, you're going to have to decide to make a decision on what point the person doesn't deserve repentance anymore. Now, we're not talking about a person that is lost by the laws of nature his ability to repent. We're talking about where God takes it away. So therefore, you have to make a decision about a certain type of evil that doesn't deserve repentance, and you have to explain why. You understand? And now, you have to have a criteria for explaining that. I don't have any criteria for explaining at what point in evil does his repentance deserve to be taken away. So therefore, it's hard for me, because of these two problems, it's hard for me to identify with that answer. I can't say that it's right. I can't say which one is right or which one is wrong. That I definitely don't have a proof for one or the other. But this answer I could relate to, because I could identify with this in everyday life. That is very clear, that hardening of the heart means that I don't look at reality correctly, namely through the overall picture. I only look at my experience. So I could identify with this answer. So therefore, I can't say it's correct. I just say it makes sense to me. The other one also makes sense to me, but I can't identify with it. You understand? I don't see anything wrong with the other answer. But to identify with the other answer, you need those two steps. And I just can't identify with it. We're up to Mishlei verse 21. It says, there will not befall a righteous man any iniquity, but the wicked are filled with evil. The first question is what does the first half have to do with the second half of the pasuk? Okay. In other words, the statement was that's the definition of a righteous person, that he never sins. The thing is, it's not so. The Gemara says that there's four people that never sin. These people you hardly ever hear of. The answer is that they were not under pressure. They lived a very quiet life. A life of contemplation, and so therefore their emotions were not awakened to the extent. I mean, it's a rarity that even a quiet life that you never sin. I mean, there's only four people that our sages mention, but the fact is that the only way you're going to get out of it is you're raised somehow well, your emotions are evenly keeled, it just came out perfect, and you just live a quiet life. But most people, all the people that were under tension, that lived a life of tension, that something happened, they ran a government, they were leaders and things like that, they're under tension. The tension awakens different emotions that you don't even know where you have until the tension comes up. They all sin. Okay? So he says is that they will never sin. You know, a righteous man will never befall a righteous man any iniquity, which means he won't fall into sin. It's not true. He does fall into sin. Right, the question is, what's the definition of sin? There are two types of sin. There's one sin that you violate the halacha, that God commanded, and two, you make an incorrect decision in life.